Hello, this is Irene Bullard. I will be reading the Bloomington Normal Pantograph dated Tuesday, March 13, 2018. Let's begin on the front page. IWU grad sees through the gore to tell stories. Author, a winner of the E.O. Wilson Award for The Butchering Art. From a self-described strange child who went from cemetery to cemetery with her grandmother hunting ghosts, Illinois Wesleyan University graduate Lindsay Fitzharris says that she grew up to be an even stranger adult. But that stranger adult has a YouTube series dedicated to the horrors of pre-anesthetic surgery, a blog called The Surgeon's Apprentice, using an archaic word for surgeon, which is spelled C-H-I-R-U-G-E-O-N, and a book called appropriately The Butchering Art. And now, thanks to that book and her skill in writing it, she has a prestigious Penn American Award, the E.O. Wilson Award for Literary Science Writing, that includes a $10,000 prize. The Butchering Art, Joseph Lister's quest to transform the grisly world of Victorian medicine, details the efforts of Victorian-era surgeon Joseph Lister to transform medical practice by developing procedures to fight the spread of germs that were leading to countless deaths. I like to say that The Butchering Art is a love story between science and medicine, Fitzharris said in a recent email interview. Joseph Lister was a visionary surgeon who persevered with his work despite a prevailing climate of skepticism and denial, she said. In this way, his story is more relevant today than it. Her book was among five finalists for the Penn America Science Writing Award. In awarding the prize, the judges said, Fitzharris is a brilliant narrator of visceral operating room scenes, but her account of the medical community's prolonged and contentious resistance to Lister is just as compelling. Visceral is a nice way of saying grisly, and her book, blog, and YouTube series Under the Knife are not for the squeamish. Yes, it can get gory, but then again, so can everyday life in the 21st century, said Fitzharris, who grew up in the Chicago suburb of Mount Prospect, but now lives in England. I don't believe I would be doing the stories of the past justice if I wasn't painting a vivid picture about just how awful it would have been to live in a pre-anesthetic and pre-antiseptic era. Although The Butchering Art is her first book, her writing talents were recognized early. IWU history professor Michael Young said Fitzharris received a 100.2 average in one of the courses that she took from him, getting perfect scores on several papers. That's rare for me because I'm a pretty hard grader, he said. I knew she had talent. I knew if she kept plugging away, it would lead to success, said Young. Fitzharris said, everyone warned me that he was the most difficult history professor on campus and that I would regret it, taking his course as a freshman. But it was the best decision I ever made. Fitzharris said, Young introduced her to the history of science and ideas and has been by far the biggest influence on my career. As an IWU junior, she spent a year studying at the University of Oxford in England. After graduating from IWU, she returned to Oxford for her doctoral degree in the history of science, medicine, and technology. But despite the advanced degrees, Fitzharris said that she considers herself, first and foremost, a storyteller. She could well have become another dull professor, but she was too creative to be confined to academia, said Young. She is reaching a lot wider audience than an academic historian usually would reach, and that audience is likely to continue to grow. My next book will be on the birth of plastic surgery told through the incredible story of Harold Gillies, the pioneering and eccentric surgeon who first united art and medicine to address the horrific injuries that resulted from World War I. There is a photo of her holding a small book, and she is wearing white gloves. It says, "At Surgeons Hall in Edinburgh, Scotland, Illinois Wesleyan University graduate Lindsay Fitzharris holds a pocketbook bound in the skin of the 19th century murderer William Burke. Penalties eyed for rental code violators. The city council says it's time to start cracking down on landlords who chronically violate Bloomington city housing codes with fines until the problems are fixed." That was the consensus of the council after a review of the city's rental inspections program at a special meeting Monday at City Hall. The discussion was prompted in part by a landlord who has amassed nearly 800 code violations at six rental properties, including one destroyed by fire last month. "The vast majority of our landlords really do want to comply, and when issues are brought to their attention, that's what they do," said Ward 4 Alderman Amelia Baragas. "The real problem that we're running into is we have a minority of landlords who are chronically non-compliant. As a city, our patience needs to run very thin and cannot be infinite because we have people in our community who are living in substandard conditions, and that is just not acceptable," she added. City Attorney Jeff Jurgens was asked to work with the Community Development Department and the city's Property Maintenance Review Board, which has landlords and tenants as members, to draft an ordinance that addresses chronically non-compliant landlords. Since the city created an administrative court in 2015 to deal with code violations, the city's focus has been on getting landlords to correct problems rather than penalizing them. For example, the city can impose a fine of $50 per violation per day, but if the problem is fixed, the fine is waived, and the violator pays only the $110 court cost. The city has two rental inspectors to handle the 12,000 rental units. The city is responsible for inspecting on a three-year cycle. But there was little support by aldermen to hire additional rental inspectors after Interim Community Development Director Bob Mart said it was not necessary. "If we are receiving a number of complaints specific to a property, there is a provision in our code that allows the director to initiate a re-inspection of that property, regardless of this three-year intent," said Mart. "We would move that up on the schedule to address those issues." The 12-unit apartment building at 1101 Gettysburg Drive had 226 violations before it was destroyed by an accidental cooking fire on February 10th. The violations were found when city inspectors conducted an inspection required by the city's regular cycle of inspections. "We were not receiving a plethora of complaints specifically related to the Gettysburg building within the last year," said Mart. "There was a large number of violations there, but we're talking about a 12-unit dwelling." Owner Wayne Pelhank and his property manager Ed Duran also have racked up almost 600 violations at another group of rental properties Pelhank owns. The city says the pair are the worst offenders on a list of landlords whose properties are in violation of city codes. Many of the landlords who chronically violate standards provide housing for low-income tenants, said Interim City Manager Steve Rasmussen and other city officials, adding that to condemn a building possibly would throw those tenants into homelessness. "I can't help but think we need to be doing a better job of educating our tenants of their rights, who to call, things that they can do to make sure their concerns will be addressed in a fair manner," said Ward 7 Alderman Scott Black. At its regular meeting following the special session, the council approved by a 7-2 vote a memorandum of understanding with the Friends of the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, an independent nonprofit organization that helps raise money for renovations and an endowment fund for the city-owned downtown venue. The agreement calls for the city to hire a fundraiser. and the friends group to contribute $20,000 toward that person's salary and benefits by April 2020. The annual contribution would increase by $20,000 annually in years 2021, 22, and 23 until it is capped at $100,000 a year by April 2024. After 2024, the group will pay the fundraiser's total salary and benefits, or $100,000 annually, whichever is higher. Democrats strong in local early voting. If early turnout for the March 20th primary is any indication, local Democrats may be in for a big year. Democrats represented 56% of early voters and vote-by-mail returns for the Bloomington Election Commission as of 8 a.m. Monday, versus just 19% of early voters for the March 18, 2014 primary election. For the McLean County Clerk's Office, which handles normal and county voters outside the city of Bloomington, Democrats made up 54% of early voters and vote-by-mail returns as of Monday. No party data was available Monday for early voters in the 2014 primary through the clerk's office. The almost law-like behavior of midterm elections is against the president's party. It will be an important referendum on Republican President Donald Trump, said John Jackson, a visiting professor of political science at Southern Illinois University's Paul Simon Institute of Public Policy. All the public polls show the Democrats enjoying the benefit of the so-called enthusiasm gap. McLean County has already seen some evidence of that enthusiasm. Democrats are running for county clerk and 5 Republican or open county board seats versus no countywide candidates and only 2 board challenges in 2016. Republicans hold 15 of 20 board seats in all countywide offices. I think it could be some reaction against Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, added Jackson, just as 2014 was some reaction against Democratic then-Governor Pat Quinn. McLean County this year became the only Illinois county where voters can pull a Libertarian ballot in the primary, but few have so far, only 14 among early voters and vote-by-mail requests across both offices. Jackson said the party breakdown is likely to change as more votes come in because the party with momentum tends to vote first. Also, some vote-by-mail requests are likely to not be returned. In-person early voting across both offices totaled 960 as of Monday versus 1,808 total in 2014's primary. Early voting starts earlier now than it did then. McLean County Clerk Kathy Michaels said that she hopes to hit 35% voter turnout for the primary versus 30% in 2014. Today is the first day we are open for early voting until 7 p.m. Will be interesting to see if more voters come in after work starting today, said Michael. Monday might see activity at Illinois State University as they come back from spring break. Early voting continues from 8:30 a.m. to 7 p.m. weekdays, 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Saturday, and 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday, through March the 20th at the County Clerk's Office, 115 East Washington Street, room 102. At the BEC at 115 East Washington Street, room 403, and Illinois State University's Bone Student Center, 100 North University Street, Normal. Daily Digest. History makers to be announced. The McLean County Museum of History will announce the recipients of this year's History Makers Awards at a news conference at 11:30 a.m. this morning in the downtown Bloomington Museum's Governor Pfeiffer Courtroom. The 4 honorees will be celebrated with live musical dramatizations at the 7th Annual History Makers Gala on June the 28th at the Doubletree by Hilton in Bloomington. Gala ticket Sales begin May the 7th at mchistory.org. Each year, the museum's History Makers Gala recognizes senior citizens whose outstanding, lifelong contributions of time and talents have helped to make it McLean County the thriving community it is today. Today in History. Today is Tuesday, March 13th, the 72nd day of 2018. There are 293 days left in the year. Today's highlight. On March 13th, 1928, at least 400 people died when the Francisquito Canyon in Southern California was inundated with water after the nearly two-year-old St. Francis Dam collapsed just before midnight the evening of March the 12th. On this date, in 1639, New College was renamed Harvard College for clergyman John Harvard. In 1781, the seventh planet of the solar system, Uranus, was discovered by Sir William Herschel. In 1865, Confederate President Jefferson Davis signed a measure allowing black slaves to enlist in the Confederate States Army with the promise that they would be set free. In 1901, the 23rd President of the United States, Benjamin Harris, died in Indianapolis at age 67. In 1925, the Tennessee General Assembly approved a bill prohibiting the teaching of the theory of evolution. Governor Austin Peay signed the measure on March 21st. In 1933, banks in the U.S. began to reopen after a holiday declared by President Franklin D. Roosevelt. In 1947, the Alan J. Lerner and Frederick Lowe musical Brigadoon, about a Scottish village which magically reappears once every 100 years, opened on Broadway. In 1954, the Battle of Dien Bien Phu began during the First Indochina War as Viet Minh forces attacked French troops, who were defeated nearly 2 months later. In 1964, bar manager Catherine Kitty Genovese, 28, was stabbed to death near her Queens, New York home. The case gained notoriety over the supposed reluctance of Genovese's neighbors to respond to her cries for help. In 1988, yielding to student protests, the Board of Trustees of Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C., or Gallaudet University, a liberal arts college for the hearing impaired, chose I. King Jordan to become the school's first deaf president. Thought for today. Bad men need nothing more to compass their ends than that good men should look on and do nothing. Written by John Stuart Mill, English philosopher and economist, 1806 to 1873. Back to articles. Mayor, city won't back out of deal. Agreement to provide funding for mental health services. The city will honor its agreement with the county and Normal to provide sales tax funding for mental health services, Mayor Terry Renner said Monday in response to questions about how the city may close an almost $3 million budget deficit. The agreement reached in 2015 calls for 25% of a 1 cent per dollar sales tax hike to be allocated to mental health related services under the countywide mental health action plan adopted in 2015. Bloomington's contribution for fiscal 2019, which will begin May the 1st, would amount to an estimated $2.27 million. Renner said Monday, the city will stand behind its commitment, outlined in a 20-year agreement, to help fund mental health services. There is the issue of morality and decency, said the mayor, adding that he would use his line item veto power to reject any move by the city council to stop the sales tax payments. Renner said that he does not anticipate the need to take such action, based on the support that he thinks exists among aldermen for the county's mental health initiative. Discussion of potential cuts to the sales tax spending plan were part of a City Council budget workshop Saturday, where the council explored ways to plug a 2.9 deficit in the $208 million budget and fund $74.5 million in capital projects. Council members reviewed a list of contributions to community programs, including mental health, $1.2 million for Connect Transit, $475,000 for the Bloomington Normal Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, $364,000 for the BN Advantage Economic Development Initiative, and $100,000 for Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. The county has used funds collected under the agreement to help pay for the cost of providing mental health services to inmates in a specialized unit that will open early next year as part of an addition to the jail. Reduction in the city's role could be detrimental to the overall effort to reform mental health services, said Sheriff John Sandage. The most vulnerable in the county would be impacted the most by any cuts. The way the county, city, and the town have worked together has made us a leader in the state of Illinois on this issue. I would hate to see anything happen to change that, said the sheriff. The county also is moving forward with an initiative to expand the number of affordable housing units available in the Twin Cities for mentally ill people. Residents will receive intensive case management services to help them remain stable and in their home under the four-year housing initiative. County Board Chairman John McIntyre said last week that about $1.5 million in sales tax revenue is earmarked for the housing project that will help about 10 people in the first year and grow to include at least 30 people, many of whom are chronically homeless, by the third year. Challengers eager in the 13th. Five Democrats vying for a chance to take on Republican Representative Davis. What was supposed to be a competitive congressional district in central Illinois has since become comfortably controlled by incumbent U.S. Representative Rodney Davis. On March the 20th, one of five Democratic candidates will be chosen to take on the three-year term Republican from Taylorville in November. If there's a Democratic wave, this is a district to watch, said Kent Redfield, a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Five Democrats have entered the race to take on Davis. First, David Gill, a Bloomington physician who unsuccessfully ran against Davis in 2012 and has run for Congress three other times. Eric Jones, an attorney from Edwardsville, who previously served as attorney with the U.S. House Oversight Committee and the Illinois Attorney General's Office. Jonathan Ebel, a religion professor at the University of Illinois Urbana and a former Navy intelligence officer. Betsy Dirksen Londrigan, a fundraiser from Springfield who has previously worked with U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat Illinois, and groups like Springfield's Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation. Angel Sides, a Springfield teacher and activist. Few policy differences set the Democratic candidates apart, with all of them supporting universal health care and tax relief for the middle class, while also opposing the Republican replacement for the Affordable Care Act and massive tax plan approved late last year. Their key differences come from their backgrounds and how they hope to achieve their policy goals. They also all agree on gun laws, such as universal background checks, and they vow not to take money from the gun lobby. Regardless of which candidate wins on March the 20th, they will likely face an uphill battle to knock off Davis. Fundraising has been a strength of Davis since his first run in 2012. With his campaign reporting just over $1.1 million on hand at the end of 2017. Redfield and John Jackson, visiting professor at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University Carbondale, said a number of factors have led to Davis retaining a strong hold on the district. Along with his fundraising ability, Jackson said the district has followed the downstate Illinois trend of becoming more conservative. Davis and other downstate congressional Republicans have done well to toe the mainline Republican Party line, in contrast to the more conservative Tea Party members of Congress. That keeps them being reelected pretty easily, Jackson said. The 13th district includes parts or all of 14 counties, stretching from the eastern parts of Champaign-Urbana to Edwardsville and stretching into the western half of Bloomington-Normal and the eastern parts of Springfield. Along with that, Redfield said, Davis has been helped by the Democrats' inability to field a strong candidate who could connect with voters outside the district's most liberal pockets. The Democratic Party has been trending more to the left nationally, and the areas of the 13th are probably growing more conservative than when the map was first drawn, Redfield said. 2. Vie in LaSalle Treasurer Race. Two Democrats are vying to become LaSalle County's next treasurer. Part-time Illinois Valley Community College and Aurora University instructor Kyle Fogel and financial planner Nikki Baer, both of LaSalle, are seeking the Democratic nomination in the March 20th primary. The winner will face incumbent Jim Spellick, a Peru financial advisor who was the only Republican to file for the office that he has held since 2014. Fogel said recently a key goal for him is to ensure the county invests locally, adding that a large amount of money that is being invested outside the county and state should be invested in local banks. He also said the county needs to cut back on spending and that he plans to donate a 6% pay increase for the treasurer's position to one student at Illinois Valley Community College. Baer said she doesn't think the position of treasurer should be a part-time job and that she would give it full-time attention. She sees the county saving money and funding efficiencies through better communication among its departments and sharing resources such as credit card processing. She also has questions about an item that she found in two different categories in the county's 2018 budget. 3. Seek Tazewell County Clerk Post. Three Republicans are seeking to succeed longtime Tazewell County Clerk and Recorder Christy Webb, who is retiring after 24 years in the office. The three contenders for the seat in the March 20th primary are familiar candidates. Shelley Hrenka, 48, of Groveland, is the county auditor. Brett Grimm, 40, of Morton, is a Tazewell County board member and self-employed futures trader. John Ackerman, 39, of Washington, formerly served on the county board. He owns a public relations consulting business. The winner of the primary will face Democrat Brittany Miller, a Washington resident who is unopposed for the Democratic nomination in the November 6 general election. Hrenka was elected in 2016 to the auditor's position, but the county board has been discussing a possible referendum asking voters if the office of auditor should be eliminated. She recently said that if she wins the clerk's job, she would be in a better position to advocate for keeping the auditor's position. Ensuring the voting system is secure and accurate are top priorities, she added. Ackerman ran against Webb, a Democrat, in 2014, but lost while garnering 45% of the vote. His campaign calls for increased county website transparency, reporting election results more rapidly, improved placement of polling places, and encouraging ongoing staff development. He has served on the county board for about 9 years, and his current term expires next year. We've come now to the end of the first half hour of the Pantograph. Please stay tuned.